Julia versus Alexander.
May it please the court, Mr. Matt Carnegie, appearing on behalf of the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'd like to begin with the issue of the professional association liability and then turn to the prejudgment interest issue in this case.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes.
Those of us who remember 1937 law review.
I'd like to begin with the liability issue and then turn to the prejudgment interest issue. The legal proposition that we contend controls this case is that if the only person who can act on behalf of a professional association, the only person whose acts are acts of the professional association, is not negligent, then the professional association cannot be negligent. We think that's the controlling legal principle.
I understand your that argument of principles, but wasn't this case tried where everybody understood at the trial court level that if you're talking about medical negligence, hands on a doctor doing something, that was the doctor individually, and if you're talking about the doctor's administrative negligence, hiring the wrong person, that was going to be submitted as the PA?
No, Justice Phillips, I don't agree with that at all. If you look first at the plaintiff's pleadings, and the critical portion of the record is page 38 of the clerk's record, is the portion of the plaintiff's pleadings that controls this. Those are the allegations of administrative negligence. And the way those are phrased, they say, Dr. Battaglia, Battaglia PA, Dr. Polk, and Polk PA all violated a duty to enforce and promulgate policies in the following respects, and then they list them. That makes two things clear. First of all, the administrative negligence allegations were made directly against the individual physicians, and second, the administrative negligence allegations against the professional associations were based on the acts of those physicians. So, for example, when the trial court granted directed verdict in favor of Dr. Polk, it was necessarily granting directed verdict on all claims alleged against Dr. Polk.
So this is a pleading issue that you're talking about. I mean, you don't quarrel with the notion that the doctor can act in two capacities, both as an administrator, as a doctor. You're just saying because the grant of a directed verdict was broad and the pleadings alleged both, it covered it.
That's correct. That's correct. He could act in two capacities clearly, but when you grant directed verdict on all claims, you're saying he's not negligent, period.
Now, well, then why not grant a directed verdict against in favor of the PA?
Well, they probably could have and should have.
I thought the trial didn't ask for it.
No, you're right. He didn't ask for it. But what he did do, which I think amounts to the same thing, is when it came time for the charge, he objected, there is no evidence of negligence to support the submission of a negligence question against the professional association. And then he elaborated on that. He said the only allegations are a vicarious liability. And I think what he's saying, if you look at this in context of the pleadings, is he's saying the allegations of negligence against this professional association are based on this doctor's acts. And therefore, since this doctor has been held not negligent in any respect, there's no basis for submitting a jury question against this professional association.
Let's say I'm an individual and I'm also a director, and I negligently hire someone. I can't be liable in my individual capacity. I may not be as a matter of law, you can't reach me, but you could reach me in my capacity as a director. Wasn't that what was happening here?
I don't think so. This is a case, as you know, a professional association doesn't provide liability insulation. For purposes of professional liability, it's treated as one and the same as the doctor. So for any professional malfeasance, if the doctor is negligent, the professional association is automatically jointly and severally liable with the doctor. Now, what the plaintiffs are trying to do here is they're trying to say, well, for the doctor, we're going to kind of parse out his negligent acts and say, for the doctor, it's medical negligence, but for the professional association, it's this administrative negligence. And by doing that, we're trying to get two entities on the hook directly liable for negligence. What that does is it allows a plaintiff in this circumstance to circumvent the statutory liability caps under the Medical Liability Act.
Well, if that's improper, though, didn't counsel at the trial court waive that objection, if not encourage it?
I don't...
By objecting on to some of those submissions and not others, and taking one to the jury and arguing them separately, and so on and so forth.
Well, no, he obtained directed verdict for Dr. Polk, and then when it came time to submit the jury questions, he objected to the submission of the jury questions against the professional associations, I think on the right grounds. There's no evidence that the professional associations did something separate and apart from what these doctors did that would justify submitting a separate jury question against the professional associations independently. There would need to be some additional acts, some separate acts from what the doctors did to justify a separate jury question. Otherwise, you're effectively asking the same question twice. And that's what the gist of the objection is. There's no evidence to justify a separate or additional one because everything that could possibly support their liability is subsumed within either the directed verdict against Dr. Polk or the jury question that's being submitted against Dr. Battaglia. Now, there's nothing in the jury question against Dr. Battaglia that says, gee, jury, you can only consider evidence against Dr. Battaglia that relates to medical negligence or that relates to acts in a particular capacity. The question was very broad. Was Dr. Battaglia negligent? And the jury answered that no. In light of that question, the breadth of that question, and the fact that the professional associations can only act through Dr. Battaglia, there was no basis to submit a separate question against the professional association, because there was no allegation or evidence that the professional association did something in addition to or separate from what Dr. Battaglia did in any capacity. So this is all covered by the directed verdict for the jury question. Now, even if you were to accept this medical administrative distinction that plaintiffs advance and I contend doesn't exist, there's still no evidence to support the submission of the jury question against the professional associations. In order to have evidence of negligence, you must have evidence in this kind of case, expert testimony, of the standard of care. Now, the Court of Appeals refused to consider that. They said that an objection to no evidence of negligence doesn't preserve an objection, that there's no evidence of the standard of care. This is the only case that I'm aware of that has ever said an objection to no evidence of negligence doesn't preserve an objection to the standard of care. And the reason, of course, is that's what negligence is. It's a violation of the standard of care. The standard of care is a vital fact that has to be proven. So when you object that there's no evidence of negligence, you're saying there's no evidence of a violation of the standard of care. No evidence of violation, no evidence of the standard. The Court of Appeals then went on to do something that I think is really a logical impossibility. They said, well, we're not going to consider the evidence, whether there's evidence of the standard of care, but we're still going to consider whether there's evidence of negligence, and they found that there was. The question is, if you look at an act and you say, well, I find that this act is evidence of negligence, the question is, how do you know if you don't know what the standard of care is and you haven't looked at it? That's what negligence is a violation of the standard of care. If you look at an act, you know, the doctor cut the nerve during the operation, therefore he was negligent. Well, how do you know? Maybe he complied perfectly with the standard of care and still cut the nerve because it's a difficult operation and that just happens. So the Court of Appeals analysis just can't work. You can't even consider the negligence question without considering evidence of the standard of care. Now here, there is no evidence of the standard of care. The experts, plaintiff's expert in this case, never talked about the professional associations at all, never talked about the standard of care for a professional association. So plaintiffs are kind of left in their brief with default arguments. They say, well, Nurse Cernusek was negligent. Since she was negligent, therefore, the professional associations must have violated their standard of care. Sort of a res ipsa argument. don't think that that's valid at all. The professional associations could have perfectly complied with the standard of care, and Nurse Cernusek still could have ended up committing a negligent act. Then they rely on evidence which isn't evidence of the standard of care. Things like Dr. Battaglia saying, I have a responsibility to ensure that patients get quality medical care. Well, that may be a statement of duty, but it's not a statement of a standard of care. The Nurse Cernusek had certain standards that she had to meet to maintain her certification as a CRNA. Well, is the standard of care for the professional associations higher than making sure she meets those requirements? The hospital had internal quality control standards and training. Is what the PAs were supposed to do, did it go above and beyond the hospital's training requirements and what they were supposed to do? There's absolutely no evidence about that. This court, in a few cases recently, American Transitional, I believe, is one that's talked about what it takes to be evidence of the standard of care. And you have to say, what is it specifically that this entity was supposed to do that they didn't do? And there is no evidence like that in this record. Now, turning to the prejudgment interest issue briefly, the issue here is what are past damages, as that phrase is used in the Medical Liability Act in subchapter P. And I think the answer to that question is addressed directly by the Act, because there is a specific definition of past damages in 1602D of the Act. Past damages are the amount awarded to compensate the claimant for past losses. They are not the amount found by the jury as past losses. And there's a very clear dichotomy in the statute between amounts awarded to compensate the claimant and amounts found by the jury. If the legislature had wanted to define past damages as amounts found by the jury, it could and would have done so, but it made a very deliberate distinction here.
Well, then why didn't they just say awarded in judgment as they had before?
They could have done that too, but I think this gets to the same place. If you construe these provisions together, what you get is it has to be awarded to compensate the claimant and found by the jury. It has to satisfy both standards. And that doesn't make found by the jury meaningless, because, for example, there are certain categories of damages that oftentimes are not found by the jury, they're stipulated. This case is a perfect example. There were $57,000 in medical expenses that were not found by the jury, they were stipulated. And nevertheless, the court awarded prejudgment interest on those two, which I think is sort of inconsistent with plaintiff's own argument. If you look at the entire purpose of this act, which is to make awards rationally related to damages to reduce doctors' liability, this idea that you can have a doctor liable for zero actual damages because of settlement credits and yet be liable for hundreds of thousands of dollars in prejudgment interest on amounts that have been, you know, paid by some other settling defendant, that the plaintiff has had the use of that money all along, doesn't make any sense at all. In addition, it creates terrible problems when you try to apply this in conjunction with 33012 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and 33013. If you have, for example, a plaintiff or a defendant who's found 1% liable and has zero liability for damages, you might think, well, he's going to be liable for 1% of the prejudgment interest that's awarded. But if you look at 33013, it doesn't apply that way. It says you apply the percentage findings to amounts found by the jury. There's no mechanism in that statute for saying we'll apply that 1% to the prejudgment interest. So you end up with this 1% liable doctor with no mechanism for reducing this prejudgment interest. The same analysis applies with regard to, for example, contributory negligence. 33012 says you apply the reduction for contributory negligence to damages. It doesn't say you apply it to prejudgment interest. And mathematically, if you apply it to damages first and then calculate prejudgment interest, you come up with a different result than if you calculate the damages plus the prejudgment interest and then apply it to contributory negligence reduction. So under plaintiff's argument, to get any reduction at all, you have to make 33012, the word damages in 33012, mean something different in medical liability cases than it means in every other kind of case. And I think that damages means damages for all cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Kennedy, vote as an argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The trial court and the Court of Appeals both correctly held that there was evidence to support the negligence finding and that the prejudgment interest was calculated correctly. The first is a pure no evidence review. The second question is a pure question of statutory construction. I'll begin with the first argument about the standard of care and the PAs, which again is a no evidence argument. And I noticed that Justice Heck in the first argument this morning pointed out that in the no evidence review of a negligence question, which this is, this court only looks at whether there is any evidence from which a rational person could conclude that there was negligence. There is more than enough evidence of that in this case.
The part that troubles us, I think, is how do you separate an entity from its only principle? I know you have a vicarious liability argument, and that's another
right.
thing, but on the direct liability, how do you do that?
You do, Your Honor, because that principle, as they repeatedly testified in this case, at different times wear different hats. Sometimes they're practicing medicine, sometimes they're administering the rules of the PA. As Justice Phillips pointed out, that was well understood in the way that this case was tried. The doctors talked about wearing different hats. As you pointed out, I believe, at the motion for directed verdict, not only did they not move for directed verdict on the PA, but when they moved for directed verdict on behalf of Dr. Colton, the judge said, are you also asking for a directed verdict on behalf of the PA? And they said, oh, no, absolutely not. Whereas if this argument were what they had in mind at the time, they certainly would have. But in the way that the case was tried, and particularly if you look at the closing argument, and counsel for plaintiff in closing argument was talking to the jury about how to interpret these questions. He said, and he was talking about question number two, and he first talked about the doctors and nurses and said, so the question is, was Nurse Cernusek, was Dr. Crowder, was Dr. Battaglia providing good, competent care? But then you get to the duties of the PA. If you're going to be an administrator, if you're going to be the exclusive provider of anesthesia services and have an exclusive contract, doesn't that have some responsibility then to provide good supervision to assure that the care inside is provided correctly, adequately, and competently? So that's the question asked about Dr. Battaglia, PA, and Dr. Polk, PA. So he clearly delineated those differences. There was no confusion. There was no two bites of the apple. There was two different types of arguments. The other way you can tell...
One thing that troubles is, will this give rise to situations where every time you go to see a doctor who's a PA and he has a nurse or someone else help with the treatment and you claim that that was negligent, you'd have one claim against the doctor for medical negligence, another claim against his association for perhaps negligently hiring the nurse or overseeing the nurse, even though it's really just him. And I had, of course, a claim against the nurse. It seems to be possible to make this same argument in virtually every case.
Only if his PA has taken on the responsibility of supervising that nurse. There's no common law duty to do that. But in this case, the PAs entered into an exclusive contract with the hospital and said, we will be responsible for making sure that those people comply with professional standards. In the way that this case was submitted to the jury, in negligence question number two, there were different instructions for the different parties that were submitted. The instruction for the doctors said, you may consider what is the standard ordinary care for a medical doctor. A medical doctor typically does not have a duty to ensure that there are policies and procedures in an anesthesia department. That's something the PA took on by contract. On the question for the PAs, they said you should consider what is the ordinary standard of care for a PA. A PA can't practice medicine by statute. So by limiting those duties and their authorities, the court was saying you can only consider what a doctor should have been doing when we ask you about the doctors, and you consider what a PA, which is essentially a business entity, can do when concluding that part of the question.
And you don't think there's expert testimony necessary in the claim against the PA for their administrative obligations?
I
do think there's expert testimony, Your Honor, about the breach. I think the question becomes whether there was an expert who uttered the magic words, the standard of care for a PA is X. And I don't think they needed to do that, and here's why. Up until a couple of years ago, the long-standing practice in medical malpractice cases articulated by this court in Hart versus Van Zandt in 1965 said that you have to have expert testimony of negligence and causation, negligence consisting of a breach of the standard of care. 2 years ago in Palacios, this court, when interpreting statutory language in 4590I about expert reports, because the statute said you have to have an expert report that articulates the standard of care, identifies the breach, and then establishes causation, the court wrote an opinion that said you have to separately articulate the standard of care based on that statutory language. Now, if this court is going to say that that applies across the board to trial testimony, it can do so. But that case came out after this case was tried. As a matter of fact, about 3 weeks before this case was tried, the Court of Appeals opinion in Palacios came out, and that opinion said that an expert report that merely said the doctor, the healthcare provider breached the standard of care was sufficient. That's the law this case was tried on. If it then changed 2 years later with Palacios, and now you have to have someone specifically articulate the standard of care, that's not something we had the benefit of at the time. And if that is going to be the rule, and if we didn't meet it, which I think we did in this case, then we're at least entitled to remand in the interest of justice to try the case again under the appropriate rules. But I think we did meet that standard of expert testimony, because in this case we had the hospital contract that it entered into with the PAs, which said we will assure that both the doctors and the nurses under us comply with all hospital policies and procedures, with professional association standards of ethics and conduct, and with the general standard of care. Now, this isn't a case where we merely said they had these duties, and if the nurse and the doctor were negligent, then the PAs are automatically negligent. I think you can read their contract that far, but you don't have to in this case, because we had expert testimony that identified specific things that they should have done but did not do that caused this plaintiff's injuries. Let me talk about two of those. The first is they said in the surgical suite there are these monitors that monitor vital signs, and there are alarms on those monitors that go off if they dip below dangerous levels. In this case, the expert said the alarms had been turned off, and the expert, Dr. Kirby, referred to the standards of two professional organizations plus his testimony about the standard of care, which said the standard requires that you have those alarms turned off. Dr. Battaglia admitted that these PAs did not have a policy against turning off the alarms, and they left that up to the individual physician. One of the problems in this case was that the nurse anesthetist did not notice vital signs for 20 minutes, and by the time she did, it was too late. If that alarm had gone off, these consequences wouldn't have followed. So that's a specific policy and procedure, not a medical treatment matter, but an administrative policy that there was expert testimony about and which there was fact witness testimony that they did not have. Secondly, there was a question about leaving CRNAs unsupervised in the surgical suite. The hospital policies and procedures in this case, which the contract required them to follow, said that anesthesia services will be provided by an anesthesiologist. CRNAs will be utilized and supervised by the anesthesiologist. An anesthesiologist who goes for a coffee break for an hour in the middle of a surgical situation like this is not supervising the CRNA. Policies and procedures also said that nurse anesthetists practice in this hospital under the supervision and direction of a licensed physician who is an anesthesiologist. Dr. Battaglia and two nurse anesthesiologists testified that it was common practice in this hospital run with anesthesia department run by these PAs to not require the doctor to be present, to not require the doctor to be supervising the CRNA. So those are two concrete policies that we had expert testimony about saying that's what you should have done and you did not do that. And that's where the breach, that's where the standard of care comes from and the breach of the standard of care that support the jury's finding of negligence. With regard to prejudgment interest, I think there are three simple points that illuminate this argument. The first is that every decision by this court about statutory construction says that the place you start your analysis is with the plain language of the statute. Here we have a statute that says you award interest based on the damages found by the trier of fact.
Past damages.
past damages, I think, Your Honor, found by the trier of fact. And the PAs have not offered any reading of that language that supports their position. As Justice O'Neill said, if they'd meant on the judgment, they would have said on the judgment. That's what it was in prior
statute. I think they're relying for their attention of the statute on the to compensate claimant, and that if they'd been compensated by a settlement, it should have been.
They rely on a definition of past damages, which says an amount awarded to compensate the plaintiff. Amount awarded is something that this court has used to describe both judgments and jury verdicts. Compensate is something that comes up in judgments and jury verdicts. Juries are asked what amount would compensate the plaintiff. If you take that definition of amount awarded to compensate the plaintiff and put it in 1602B, it says you award damages based on the amount awarded to compensate the plaintiff found by the trier of fact. So the only way you can harmonize that definition of past damages and the language about found by the trier of fact is to find the amount awarded to compensate the plaintiff found by the trier of fact must be found by the trier of fact. That's what the plain language of the statute indicates. The second point is that this court is must presume that when the legislature passes statutes, it is aware of common law interpreting that matter. When this statute was passed in 1995, the year before, this court had decided CNH Nationwide, and one of the things the CNH Nationwide case said was that the phrase damages found by the trier of fact means the jury verdict before deducting settlement credits. There was another case decided 2 years earlier, Sisters of Charity versus Dunsmore, that interpreted language in a different statute about amount of the judgment, which said that means damages after deducting settlement credits. So the legislature had a choice. It could follow the language in Dunsmore about the judgment, or it could follow the language in CNH Nationwide that says damages found by the trier of fact, which we know means before deducting settlement credits. And the legislature chose the language damages found by the trier of fact, which had been interpreted the year before by this court in CNH Nationwide. Finally, the third point is that in the 1995 legislative session, there were two different bills that came to the legislature. One of them had language about damages awarded on the judgment that died in committee. The other one had language about damages found by the trier of fact, and that was passed.
Is there anything in the history that indicates that anybody intended a difference one way or the other?
Nothing that we've been able to find, Your Honor. So based on the plain language of the statute, based on this court's presumption that the legislature was aware of what CNH Nationwide said that language meant, and based on the legislature's consideration of the two different statutes, if this court were to go in the PA's interpretation, that would honor the rejected statute and reject the past statute, which is certainly contrary to legislative intent.
Can you address Mr. Carnegie's argument that the pleadings didn't permit the argument you're presenting here? In other words, that everything was based on the doctor's conduct, and that sort of flowed up through their conduct, and that's how you pleaded the case.
In the pleadings, there are two separate paragraphs. One paragraph has a series of bullet points that talk about medical negligence. The next paragraph has a series of bullet points that talk about administrative negligence. It's true that at the beginning of both paragraphs, the plaintiff's pleadings pled generally and said all defendants have done all of these acts. I don't think the court is limited by that. It's limited by the way the case was tried, by the proof, and by the jury charge. And as I say, the jury charge, by focusing on the duties of a medical doctor versus the duties of a PA, which is a business entity, solves that problem. Unless the court has any further questions, we ask that this case be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Carnegie, if there's no evidence to support a submission to the jury, the proper request is a direct verdict. Is that right?
Correct.
And
correct.
So
or in this case, a rendition of judgment.
So why was there no objection to submitting the PA to the jury?
There was an objection to submitting the PA to the jury.
Was there a motion for directed verdict on the PA?
No, there was no motion for directed verdict on the PA, but there was an objection to the submission of the question to the jury on the PA on the basis of no evidence of negligence. Both PAs.
But there is an exchange in the charge where the judge says you're talking about the doctor.
The exchange is in the context of the motion for directed verdict. Mr. Wilson, the trial counsel, moved for directed verdict on behalf of Dr. Polk. And plaintiff's counsel essentially conceded there was no evidence of medical negligence and said, but you're not asking for a directed verdict with regard to Polk PA, are you? And Mr. Wilson said no, and then he said, but I'm moving that there is for directed verdict on behalf of Dr. Polk because there is no evidence that he was negligent in any regard whatsoever. So clearly he is moving for directed verdict in favor of Dr. Polk on the grounds that there's no evidence of negligence of anything that is alleged against him in the pleadings, which includes the administrative negligence. Now when they say, oh gee, the judge understood that he was only granting directed verdict on medical negligence, that's refuted if you look at the final judgment itself. On the second page of the final judgment, about four lines from the top, it says, after the close of the evidence and prior to the submission of the charge to the jury, all claims against Tommy A. Polk, M.D., were dismissed on directed verdict. So there's no question here that the directed verdict was on all claims, including the administrative negligence claims. Now, so...
That seems circular to me. You say all claims against M.D., that's medical negligence.
All claims against M.D. has to refer to all claims that are alleged against M.D. in the plaintiff's pleadings.
Which would not include P.A.
Which don't include P.A., but they include all of the allegations of medical negligence. So what that directed verdict establishes is administrative negligence. Because what the allegations are is Tommy Polk was administratively negligent. Tommy Polk, PA, was administratively negligent. Well, why? Because Tommy Polk, acting for the PA, is doing administratively negligent things,
but
according to the plea.
If the trial court thought that, why wouldn't the trial court have asked the question, well, you're not meaning to dismiss against the PA, and then over objection, submitted the PA's negligence? I mean, if the trial court really thought what you say was communicated, it doesn't seem like the trial court would have acted the way it did.
Well, I think that argument sort of begs the question. The legal issue, you may be right, but the legal issue here is, as a matter of law, Tommy Polk wasn't negligent. He wasn't administratively negligent or medically negligent. What's the legal effect of that finding? In light of that finding, can you then submit a question against the PA? Because if Tommy Polk wasn't negligent, who was it who acted on behalf of the PA that caused the PA to be negligent? And then if you look at the jury question against Dr. Battaglia, I would concede that hypothetically, at least, you could submit two questions, one against Dr. Battaglia and one against the PA, but not when you submit the question as broadly against Dr. Battaglia as you did, such that it subsumes everything that the PA could possibly have done. In that circumstance, you're just asking the same question twice. So you can't... You would have to have some separate or additional negligence that is not subsumed within the question against Dr. Battaglia in order to justify the additional question against the
PA. Did you argue there was a conflict in the findings?
No, because technically the way that you judge a conflict, I don't think a fatal conflict can ever exist when it's two separate parties. So I think it really is a true no evidence point. And a point that Mr. Wilson made about this vicarious liability argument that he made, which is essentially the PA's liability is based on what this doctor's doing. There's no separate thing here to justify the separate submission against the PA.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. And that concludes the argument and the second clause. The court will take a brief recess.